Welcome back, Louder Success. Let's take one more step up today. You listeners are getting more awesome every time you come back, so thanks for listening. Thanks even more for the feedback. As always, my name's Bailey. You can find me on Twitter at Buffalo Consults or through email just if you spell my name right, Bailey at BuffaloConsults.com. In normal construction, I'm not even sure what I call normal. There is a medium for getting project reimbursements through a claims process that you kind of hope you never have to use. But when you get into federal projects, and those are projects specifically governed by the federal acquisition regulations, there's another option called the REA, which is the Return for Equitable Adjustment. And if you want to know what the difference between that and a claim is, just keep listening. My guest today can explain that a whole lot better than I can, and the reason for that is because it's a specialty for his company, which is Resolutions Management Incorporated. Their website, resmgt.com. Jeff Kozik's career is focused on managing and mitigating claims and disputes in construction, so he's the perfect source to go to with this. He also just happens to be giving a presentation on this topic at the upcoming conference for AIC, the American Institute of Constructors. So, Mr. Kozik, for contractors who may not be familiar with the FARs and the REAs and all the acronyms, what is a request for equitable adjustment, and when might it be necessary for a contractor to have to file one of those?
Well, a request for equitable adjustment, typically called an REA, is usually submitted in response to a request for relief under a particular contract provision or through an allegation there exists a constructive change. And a constructive change is basically something, an example of that would be defective specification, where or maybe the work is impossible to perform. So it's either a contract provision that you have a right to recover under that's included in your contract documents, or it's something that really is a change, but it's labeled as a constructive change because it's, as I said, like the plans and specs are not sufficient to build. So the contractor has the right to request additional time and or compensation because of that condition.
I've done work on projects that are under the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regs, and I know there's not a complete definition, so to speak, of a claim, but there are requirements for what constitutes a claim. How does an REA differ from a claim, and when is an REA become more practical?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if it's that clear cut. If you're looking for additional time and compensation, you can call it an REA, you can call it a claim, but there are, as you mentioned, there are different parameters going towards that. So whereas an REA comes out as, and I'll give you an example, let's say your contract has a federal acquisition regulation clause called a differing site condition. And that comes into play when either it deals with a subsurface condition, or let's say the project is a renovation of existing building and there's hidden areas in behind a wall or in the ceiling that through a reasonable site investigation, you wouldn't have been able to discover prior to being awarded the job. So in the one instance, an REA would be, okay, you encountered a differing site condition and there's a differing site condition clause and you're seeking additional time and or money because of that condition. So you typically would submit that as an REA. And let's say there's an example where it's the same type of example, and it's acknowledged by the government contracting officer that yes, this is a change, and you're entitled to a contract modification. So you prepare a proposal to indicate how much you're entitled to. And then the contracting officer will look at that and render a decision one way or another. The claim is a more formal submittal where there's not an acknowledgement that you're entitled to something, but there's a dispute. And let's say, using the same example, contractor believes there's a differing site condition, and the contracting officer says, no, there isn't. We don't interpret that. So then that could become a claim because you do the work because the contracting officer says, continue with the work because that was included within your scope and you should have known about that. And it doesn't fall under that clause. So now you're submitting a claim because you've incurred additional costs and it may have affected your time of performance and pushed it past the contract completion date. So now you're in a claim situation. So there's differences with regard to that. For instance, if it's submitted as an REA, you may be able to recover more costs under an REA than you can under a claim. And by that, I mean, not obviously your direct costs, your direct costs and so on. But let's say you had to bring in somebody, a geotechnical consultant, to make a determination to help you, say, you know, set up your REA with regard to soil borings and showing what the conditions were. And maybe you had it, you needed a little legal help. So those type of costs may be recoverable under an REA, whereas if it's a claim situation, typically legal and consulting costs are not recoverable. There's also a requirement for certification of your claim, of your REA or your claim. Typically under the REA there is, and you have to, and there's language you can pull off the internet that's part of the contract, part of the, in the FARs and so on, that you basically have to say that the claim is being made in good faith and that your supporting data is accurate and complete. For a claim, if it's over, I think the number is $100,000, you have to include additional language saying that you believe this is the amount that's in dispute that the government owes you. So there's just specified requirements, and if you just follow the recipe, you'll be fine. Another difference, though, is if you're submitting an RFI or REA, you submit that, and they can say yay or nay. If you're submitting a claim, you submit a claim to the contracting officer, and the contracting officer has to render what's called a contracting officer's final decision. And typically, that's around a 60-day turnaround, but then they can ask for more time if the claim is more complex, and it will need more time to investigate it. So whatever that time period is, if the contractor can either accept your claim totally, or accept it in part, or it can reject it entirely. Or the contracting officer may not even respond, and if it's failure to respond within the time allotted, then it's deemed a denial in total. With an REA, if the parties all of a sudden can't agree on that, then that can be filed as a claim, and you go through that process. Time limitations really depends on type of claim, but obviously this, the and I don't recall right offhand whether a specified time you have to submit it, but for instance, we're talking about a differing site condition. There's requirements of notice. You have to notice within a certain amount of time and before you're going forward, because you have to give the owner, in this case, let's say the government, an opportunity to examine that and see what they want to do and so on. But in terms of submitting the REA or claim, obviously the sooner the better. So they're pretty much the differences between the two. And when do you use one and when do you use the other? It really depends on a lot of different factors. Is, you know, what is the history of that project? Is it been one that the party's been working well together? What's the relationship that the contractor has with the contracting officer? So, you know, you might want to do one and not, you know, raise any red flags, and you're getting along well and you think, let me do an REA and maybe we can get that resolved. But if the parties are, you know, been battling left and right and they've been rejecting other things or it's just not going right, you might want to say, I might as well go fast forward and submit a formal claim. Now, if the REA is rejected or the claim is rejected, then you have the right to appeal and go into either the Board of Contract Appeals or to the Court of Federal Claims. And each of them have a little bit of differences, and it's up to the contractor again there with regard to his experience with either the board or the Court of Federal Claims, where the contractor or his attorney feels more comfortable and where they maybe will get a better shake, where time-wise it may come into play. A lot of different factors. So that's, in a nutshell, kind of what the difference is between the REA and the claim.
You covered a couple of questions that I already kind of made up my mind to ask while you were talking, but you kind of went over this one already, and I was going to ask, is there a time when, any time when it's best not to file the REA and go straight into the claim? So, but it sounds like it's in everyone's best interest to kind of be on the contracting officer's good side, so to speak, so you can go for the REA. But when you...
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry. Let me comment on that. I mean, that applies to any job. Most of the times that we see problems when there's a dispute and they cannot get resolved, not every time, but there's a certain element of it in is that the parties are just not working together, and there's not a mutual agreement to try to get along and try to work things out. And there could be a variety of reasons, again, for why that is. So it's always good to stay on the good side, but that doesn't mean at some point in time your parties can agree to disagree, and then it might be, why am I wasting time with this? I'm going to go right to the claim. I believe that's the best procedure to do, when I'll get a more timely result, and then I can move forward from there.
Gotcha. So when you are drafting the REA, putting that together to send into the contracting officer or whoever, what's the information data that has to be included in that?
Well, I mean, whether you're submitting an REA or a claim, it's really the same information. Some try to do it on a shortcut basis, a down and dirty basis, a summary basis, and usually that's not going to work. It's quicker, it's cheaper, but you're not going to get the result you want, because you have to put yourself in the position of the government in this case and say, I need enough information to be able to feel comfortable that this is warranted. So whether it be a claim or RIA, you're looking at certain things. One, you have to establish under the contract the liability portion, meaning I'm entitled under the contract to recover additional time and compensation, whether it's an REA or it's a claim. And what contract provision or provisions am I trying to recover under? And that could even apply, I mentioned previously, constructive change. When you read the changes clause, which is typically, you know, a FAR provision in every contract, that is going to talk about a change being a written order or something else that's less than a written order, a verbal directive, or as I said, a differing site, effective specification is not going to be any kind of written or verbal order. It's just going to know that's going to fall into place. So that can be recovered. So you're arguing under a particular clause of the contract or clauses to establish your liability. And then there's other clauses that go into it, meeting notice. Did you meet the notice requirements? And at times courts could strictly follow what the notice requirements are. And even though you may be entitled to recover something, if you didn't meet the notice requirements and in some manner prejudice the owner by not letting the owner know in a timely manner, you could be precluded from recovering under that. So the first is liability. And then as part of that, with the contract clauses, correspondence relating to the issue, whether it be letters or primarily today, they're emails that talk about this. And maybe a government, the authorized representative of the government, recognizes that this is something that the contractor is it's an expert to the contractor. So first you establish that you're entitled to it. Then you have to establish, okay, and even if you're entitled to it, are you entitled to a time extension, and are you entitled to additional costs? And let's tackle the additional costs first. If there's extra work that you believe that needs to be accomplished, then you're talking about direct costs, labor, material, equipment, additional field overhead, and so on. So there's additional costs that you would have to provide support. And if it's work that's going to be done in the future and you're prospectively trying to establish what the cost is, then you have either historical data from the job that you could use to show this is what it costs on here and this is what it's going to cost for continued work, or there's going to be quotations from suppliers or receipts from, let's say, material you've already purchased. So information and support that the numbers you're coming up with for the direct costs are reasonable and are related to this extra work. Now, there's another cost element, but that goes to really related to time, because time is money. So if there's an REA for additional work, that's going to typically encompass more time. And so how do you figure out whether I have to do more work, it's going to take more time? Does that automatically say that my contract end date is going to be extended? Maybe yes, maybe no. So you typically have to perform, and every contract is a little different, but you have to look at the language and what do they require you submit in terms of what's typically termed a time impact analysis, or TIA. And so that's, in this case, would be a prospective or forward-looking change. And so you'd say, well, here's my current schedule, and it's critical path method schedule typically on these jobs. And that schedule shows when the job is going to be done, and it can be performed within the time frame that the contract says it will. And then that schedule is typically updated periodically, usually monthly, unless it's a very short job. And it shows the status of what's actually been accomplished and whether the project is ahead of schedule, on schedule, or behind schedule. So as you update the schedule, say every month, and then this problem occurs, you take the schedule in effect immediately prior to that occurrence of the event, and then you incorporate whatever additional work you believe you have to do into that schedule, and that is in the form of either additional activities that you add to the schedule for the new work, or it's existing activities in the schedule, but it's going to take you longer, so the duration that was before 5 days is now 10 days. So you increase the duration of the original activity. So by putting in new activities or increasing the durations of existing activities or changing the logic of how the activities sequence and so on, that's called a fragnet. It's a fragmentary network. So you incorporate that into the latest accepted schedule, and that will show you whether you're entitled to a time extension or not. So that's the element for time. Once you establish the time, and let's say in our scenario, it's 30 additional days, then the contractor says, well, I'm going to have additional costs because of that 30 extra days. I've covered my direct costs already, as we talked about, but these are costs related to time. For instance, I have field office overhead. I expected to be on this job for 12 months. Now I'm going to be on the job for 13 months. I don't have that extra cost for field office overhead, that extra month. And by field office overhead, I'm talking about a trailer, project engineer, secretary, a porta potty, a utility cost, whatever is encompassed by the general conditions of the work on the site. So that's a direct overhead cost that you're entitled to. Also, depending on the situation, let's say contractor had labor rates at a set amount, and in that 13th month, the beginning of the next year, labor rates were going to rise. So now you're going, you know, hopefully you would pick that up. If you don't pick that up in the direct costs for the new work, if any of the existing scope work is now pushed into the 13th month, well, now you're getting paid for labor rates that you had in the bid that are lower than the labor rates for the work that you're going to be performing in that 13th month. So there's escalation costs, and that can relate to material, could relate to labor. You may have to keep equipment on site longer than you plan to. So there are all costs like that related to time, besides field office overhead. And then there's another element, which we can talk about later. I think that is worth talking about later, is extended or unabsorbed home office overhead, which is a whole separate question in itself. But that's basically what you have to do and provide the support for. One, I'm entitled to the contract. I've established that the government is liable under the contract. Two, that I'm entitled to these costs, direct and time-related costs. And three, I'm entitled to a time extension of X number of days because it affected the critical path and pushed out the project completion date beyond what the contract said I was entitled to.
And see, this is why it's always best to ask certain questions to a real expert, because I'm glad no one asked me. I wouldn't know where to start. Your presentation at the upcoming AIC conference is 7 Keys to a Successful Equitable Adjustment Recovery. And I'm sure it's a presentation you give routinely and at the AIC when people are paying to come listen. So I don't want to give away everything for free just because, well, that's bad business. But can you summarize 2 or 3 of those keys for me for a successful recovery on these?
Let me pick a couple. Let's talk about the one about what does my contract or jurisdiction allow me to recover? Okay, that's one item I want to talk about. And there's certain items of recovery that are handled differently depending on what state you're in, what jurisdiction you're in. You could be in state court, you could be in federal court. So it varies. They don't all play to the same tune of music. So it's not like, and it's also not like in other non-construction issues where these foremost issues that are going on are decided by the Supreme Court of the U.S. Very few cases, construction cases, ever get to the U.S. Supreme Court. And as a matter of fact, I think the most famous one was U.S. v. Spearin, which was in 1918. So what you can have are differing decisions based on where you are. And there's a couple things that I want to talk about. One is, I mentioned before, And that was a good segue you gave me because it talks about, you know, I talked about extended or unabsorbed home office overhead. And what that is, that's different than the field office overhead, which is tangible and easy to see. If I have to keep a trailer there an extra month, it's going to cost me an extra month's rental. Fine. Home office overhead is a little different. So if a job, this concept arose in the early 1960s. It was a government contract for one of the military branches by a company out of Pittsburgh called Iclay Corporation. And they came up with a formula because they said, if the job is delayed, and in that case, the work was suspended for a period of time. I don't recall how many months, but it was suspended. So the contractor, you know, has certain costs. Some are variable, some are fixed. So the variable ones, if you're not having a crew out there, you don't have to have the people working. There are certain costs that you can shut off at the spigot. There's other costs that are fixed that you cannot. So contractor has a home office. And let's do the scenario that he has five projects. They all last 1 year and they're all worth $10 million each. Well, from those projects, they have to generate enough money to cover the home office overhead costs. Home office overhead by the either the mortgage paid on the building of the headquarters of the contractor or the, you know, rental cost if they're renting space, the officer's salaries who are overhead, their executive assistants, utilities, you know, heat, light, power, all that kind of stuff is a cost that's spread over these different jobs. And just because job one out of five was suspended doesn't have any effect on the home office other than the fact that now the home office still has to support that job because it's going to be going on later after the suspension is lifted, but it's not getting any allocation of additional costs from job one because that's not a change. It's a suspension of work and the contractor is not getting any more work until they start back up and they're finishing their original scope. So a job that may have been a year that was suspended for 3 months is now going to be a 15-month job. So for those 12 months, it's not sharing 50% or apportioning 50% to that allocation for the home office overhead being 20%. 20% times five jobs is 100. So there's a misallocation of overhead. It doesn't cost the home office anymore because they're still incurring the same costs that are fixed, but they're not getting their share, that 20% share from that job because no revenue is being brought in. So that's the Iclay Corporation calculation. And they figured out this calculation for unabsorbed home office overhead. Then that has, and the court accepted that, and then it's been in and out of favor. It's accepted, but there are there are limitations. You have to pass certain tests in order to do that. And so if you get by that, you're entitled to your additional overhead costs based on this formula that you're incorporating additional, and carrying overhead and that for those delay days, you can capture some of that overhead that was misallocated. So it's a tough item to get, but once you understand that, it's real easy with the formula if you have the right numbers. But then besides the fact that the court has a stringent test in order to get that, then it's handled differently depending where you are. So if you're in federal court, if you have any of these claims that go before the Armed Services Board or the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals, which is any claim with with any of the government agencies, they will entertain the ICLEI, assuming you meet these requirements, and that's fine. But if you're like in a court in Ohio, and they may or may not recognize the ICLEI Corporation formula and acceptance of that. And for instance, in New York, they reject ICLEI, and they have a formula that if you're suspended and you're not doing any direct work, you get zero. If during that suspension period you do any direct costs, although say nowhere near what you should be doing if you weren't suspended, we'll give you a markup of say 15% on those direct costs. So it's one to say that I'm going to put in a claim for this cost element, but depending where you are, they may recognize or may not. I'm in New Jersey, and there is not one court case that you can look at that talks about the ICLEI formula. So who knows whether they would accept it or not. So that's the ICLEI. Another one is a clause that's found typically in a lot of different contracts, public and private. It's been around for a while, called a no damages for delay clause. And basically what that says in plain language is that If I'm the owner and I do something to you that would typically be a compensable delay, meaning you get time and money, under the no damages clause, I'll give you time, but you're not getting any more money. So that's a real stringent clause. And in many public contracts, state courts have recognized that as saying it's beyond public policy. It's prohibited by, you know, public policy. You shouldn't be able to do that. It's just not right. And they will not accept that provision. In other states, they'll accept the provision, but they'll read it very narrowly, and they have many exceptions. And then if you can establish one of these exceptions, and one is it was beyond the reasonable contemplation of the parties at the time of contracting that this would happen. So it's unfair to say the contractor should only get time and he should have known that this could have happened. So there's many recognized exceptions to that. Or another one is active interference by the owner. The owner shouldn't be rewarded by actively interfering with the contractor and putting the contractor in this position and then saying, I'll give you a time extension, but I'm not giving you any money. So again, some states and some courts will strictly look at that but accept it, and other courts, other jurisdictions won't. So you have to be aware of, you know, where am I? And I don't expect the normal contractor to have the time to learn that or have the law degree, and that's why you have your outside counsel or internal counsel, excuse me, to help you out there. Another one that is one of those seven keys is the concept of concurrent delay. And what is that? Well, let's say I'm working for an owner, and a contractor submits a claim or an REA, because in private contracts, sometimes they're mixed in terms of whether it is it's named by, you know, six of one, half dozen other in terms of the name. An REA and claim can be synonymous. So you're submitting something, and the contractor submits and says he's entitled to so much time and so much money. And typically, usually, unless it's a school and it has to be open by a certain date, the time is not as much of a problem. And that's not a general rule, but sometimes owners are more willing to give time because they recognize the job's going to be late and it's not going to affect them, especially if it's their fault and they recognize that. But, you know, it's another thing to hand out more money. And so what you're looking at when the contractor submits something, you're only probably getting one side of the story. This is what the contractor said the owner or the owner's, you know, authorized representatives did to the contractor, which caused this situation in which he's now asking for additional time or money. So as an owner's working for an owner, I'm looking and saying, okay, maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but let's assuming it's true. Was there anything that the contractor or its subcontractors or suppliers did independent of that delay that also could have delayed this project? And thus, what you're looking for is a problem that the contractor had either by himself or through its subcontractor suppliers that would have delayed the job anyway, either the whole time that the owner caused delay was ongoing or part of that time. And the reason for that is if you can establish a concurrent delay, then what that has the effect of is it wipes out the compensation portion. Because if the contractor is delayed due to an owner problem, contractor is entitled to time and money. However, if the contractor would have been out there anyway for that period of time, all or part of it, well, you'll still get the time because the owner would have delayed you. But since you delayed the job as well, that wipes out the compensability element. So that's the goal of always trying to find whether there's concurrent delay, despite the fact that you, as a party, may have delayed the other party to a certain extent, because that would help wipe out all or part of the compensability portion of the claim. I guess another one would be, I'll just touch on briefly, is a loss of productivity. It's kind of an easy concept to understand, but it's very difficult to put words to paper and to come up with a computation that's very clear, that's foolproof. And the concept behind loss of productivity, where you have delay, where time is money because the job's extended and you have these additional costs to keep going, and a loss of productivity, you're talking about disruption. And disruption could occur on a job it still gets done within the original contract period, or there still could be a delay and also a disruption. And disruption is basically where the contractor's reasonable approach to doing the project is interrupted such that it takes many more labor hours to complete the original scope of work than was anticipated in its bid. And so basically the contractor is looking for, I estimated 15,000 hours and I actually spent 17,500 hours and I had, and that was not due to any contract modifications. That was the original scope of work. Why, you know, I incurred an additional 2,500 labor hours because I wasn't allowed to work in a reasonable manner. And it was all caused by others, not my fault or not under my control. So you're looking for additional labor hours, and there may be equipment hours associated with that as well. So that's the disruption portion, and the matter of, well, how can you capture those hours, which is easier said than done, because many times, either because the contractor doesn't have the capability or hasn't spent the time to do it based on the sophistication of their tracking system, to record hours that are associated with out-of-scope work or associated with work that's not out of scope, I'm sorry, but it's related to the delayed work or the disrupted work. And so therefore, these are hours that I spent only because of the disruption I was experiencing because of what, you know, situation I was put in. And so that's a difficult way. And usually they're mixed in and there's many different methods of trying to figure that out. And some are much better than others. And so if you don't have your actual numbers broken out, then there's different formulas you can use. And the more you go to formulas and more going to summary estimations are much easier to attack. So there's three of the seven that I would be planning to talk about.
Awesome. So tell me about your company, Resolution Management Consultants, real quick. What are some of the other services that you offer, and what do you specialize in any industries other than construction?
Well, we're a professional firm. Really serving really two major, put them in two spheres. The first I'll call project management support services. And that could be in terms of before the job even starts, talking about proper project delivery systems and risks involved in that. It can be talking about helping them with their contract revisions, understanding them. If they're putting out the contract, helping them, let's say, with their scheduling provision or their contract modification provisions. So we don't have the problems that I've talked about in this discussion here. We could help them once the job starts. We could help them with scheduling, either helping put together the schedule and subsequent updates during the job and time extension requests, or we could work for the owner side reviewing schedules submitted by contractors to see if they meet the requirements of the scheduling specification. We also work during the job to help out a client who doesn't have the particular expertise in-house for a particular problem, or some problems come up and they want to try to resolve it now so a molehill doesn't become a mountain at the end of the job. And so we'll come in and work with them to help them. And that also includes the work can be done back in our office, or sometimes we'll put someone or two people out on site for a couple days, couple weeks, couple months, if that's what's needed. And so that's the project management support services, where we're really serving as an extension of the client's staff to help them where they need the help the most. The other end of the spectrum is the construction claims dispute resolution, whereas we either can work for a contractor, a subcontractor, construction manager in helping them put together a request for equitable adjustment or claim to meet the requirements that I previously talked about liability, causation, and quantum or damages. Or we're working for a side that's received a claim and we're reviewing that claim to see if it has merit. And if it does, are the time extensions and costs that they are requesting are reasonable. And then we can serve as an expert witness. We can help them in negotiations. We can support mediation, or we can serve as an expert witness in arbitration or trial if it gets to that point. In terms of industry, it's any industry in the construction process that builds anything, and it's horizontal or vertical construction, whether it be international work, transportation work, power, environmental, industrial, schools, healthcare. The terminology is different. The technology may be a little different. The structure that they're building is a little different, but the processes are all the same, and the problems they have are pretty much all the same.
Well, sounds like y'all do great work, and no doubt have some very much needed expertise going on here. So if somebody wants to follow you, your company on social media, or even just reach out to you for help, what's the best way for them to do that?
A variety of ways. We have a website, which is www.resmgt.com. They can obviously call us by phone. We have a toll-free number, 800-390-8800. We're also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Twitter is twitter.com/resolution, spelled out, and then MGT. LinkedIn is linkedin.com/company/resolution MGT. And then on Facebook, it's facebook.com/resolution MGT. But on that one, for whatever reason, the R is capitalized and the M is capitalized in resolution management, and followed by a slash. So there are different ways you can get to us.
Sounds great, Jeff. That's a lot of knowledge in a short amount of time. So I wish I could make it to your full presentation at the AIC conference, but I'm going to be stuck in the mountains of Washington State somewhere. So maybe somebody can give me some notes on the rest of your points. So anyway, thank you so much for your time. This has been great.
You're welcome.